Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Again, this week we'll take an international look at the drug war. We'll have an interview with Steve Rolls from Transform, the British drug reform organization. We'll have reports from Alison Murden, a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and perhaps the first person ever to use Sativex, the whole cannabis plant extract. And we'll hear from Philippe Lucas of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, perhaps the second to use Sativex. But first, a Drug Truth Network editorial. 90-plus years after the Harrison Narcotics Act sparked the first skirmishes, the drug war rages on, unabated, ever escalating, despite having no chance whatsoever of success. Over the decades of fighting flowers for the sake of the children, the U.S. influence and outright requirements of other nations to participate in international drug treaties and the U.S. interpretation of scientific fact stand as the primary forces working to assure the policy of eternal drug prohibition. The drug warriors of planet Earth, mostly U.S. politicians, cops, judges, scientists, and others whose work serves to instigate themselves into the mechanisms of drug war, as it turns out, are the vastly underpaid and highly uninformed minions of the true drug lords, the bankers, the multinational corporations, and the drug cartels. Okay, and now let's go to Great Britain to see how the drug war is working out over there.
My name's Stephen Rolls. I'm the information officer for Transform Drug Policy Foundation, which is a campaigning charity organisation based in the UK. And we're campaigning for a just and effective drug policy, including the legalisation and regulation of currently illegal drugs.
There was a report that had been sent to Tony Blair about the situation on drugs. And if you will, please summarise that for my listeners.
The report was actually commissioned by Tony Blair from the Number 10 Strategy Unit, which is a group of policymakers based in Number 10 Downing Street. It's basically Tony Blair's private policy group, and they produce reports on issues he's interested in. And sometimes he acts on them and sometimes he doesn't. This report was actually commissioned, in late 2002, and it was presented to Tony Blair and some key ministers in summer 2003. It wasn't published. Some of the Strategy Unit reports are published, some of them aren't. This one wasn't. Until very recently, last Friday, half of the report was made available under the Freedom of Information Act following various requests, including from us and from Transform. And the remainder of the report was then leaked to the media. So the whole report is now in the public domain. What the report basically is a kind of guided tour of the failure of supply-side drug interventions. Basically, it's a very fierce and detailed critique of the war on drugs. It goes through crop eradication, attempts to prevent trafficking, attempts to prevent money laundering, and attempts generally to prevent drugs entering the country. And it concludes with a lot of detailed statistics and graphs and a lot of data that's in the public domain, some data that isn't, but it's all fairly familiar stuff to people in the law reform movement, because basically it concludes that none of those things work, that crop eradication has failed historically and will continue to do so, that attempts to prevent drug trafficking have failed historically and will continue to do so, money laundering the same, and similarly looked at overall, we failed to prevent drugs entering the country, and it explains why that is. It basically says that the risk carried by dealers inflates the price of drugs to such a point that the market is so lucrative that any attempts we make to crush it or to prevent it or to intercept the drugs inevitably fails because it simply moves somewhere else. Crop development will move to a different area. Traffickers will seek different routes. Smugglers will find new ways into the country. Money launderers will always find new ways to launder money. So basically, it's acknowledging the failure of the whole enterprise in a great deal of detail.
The report that was issued by the strategy group, as you say, was presented by the media in the UK, and yet here in the US, there has not been one word issued about that report. Your thoughts on that, sir?
It was very unfortunate, really, that the report came out during a week in the UK, certainly, that was, in news terms, as momentous probably as there's ever been. We had the Live 8 concerts, we had the G8 Summit of World Leaders, we had the UK winning the Olympics bid, and then the following day we had the terrorist bombs in London. So it's been a massive news week. This particular story, which in any other week would have been massive, really, got lost, really, amongst all this other huge news, which was a great shame for us, really. It did get some decent coverage in the UK. It was covered fairly extensively by the BBC on Sunday, Sunday a week ago. And it was the lead front page story headline in the Guardian newspaper on Tuesday. It was also covered in the Telegraph, in the Observer newspaper, and in the Independent newspaper, as well as the Daily Mirror, one of our leading tabloids. So it did get some coverage, but certainly it was eclipsed by all the other news. In terms of international interest, we can only do so much in terms of international press work, but we certainly alerted our colleagues at the Drug Policy Alliance. I sent some details to Narco News and Drug Reform Coordination Network and some of the other US groups who we've been in contact with, and I think they will have distributed press releases. I don't know why the US press hasn't picked up on it. Really, it's very damning of a policy that essentially has been invented and perpetuated by the US and which is now supported most strongly by the US. And effectively, this report is critiquing American-style hands-on interventions, drug supply, interdiction, and so on. So it is actually very revealing from a historical... From a US perspective. The fact that England has such close ties with the US, I think, makes it more pertinent. I think the fact that Tony Blair and George Bush have such a close relationship may be a factor in this. I mean, the fact is you've got a report commissioned by and presented to Tony Blair which says one of our mainstay policies is a complete waste of time and may actually be making things worse. And yet they continue with it. And I think one of the reasons why it wasn't published and why they have continued with that policy is because they don't want to upset the Americans. They don't want to upset this special relationship, and they don't want to upset the international consensus, which is largely sort of perpetuated and maintained by US pressure. It's a story that warrants more attention in the US and internationally. We did do some international work. It was picked up by some newspapers in France. And around and about Europe, but in America, no, there hasn't been any interest. A great shame, really. This report came at a time when Blair had been in power for 5 years. His 10-year drug strategy is halfway through, and it's clearly all the sort of policy indicators are going the wrong way. Problem drug use is rising, drug deaths are rising. UK has the highest level of problem drug use in Europe. Our prison population is exploding. There seems to be, a huge amount of crime is clearly created by, is drug related. It was clearly an issue that policy wasn't getting to grips with, and I think that's why he commissioned the report. What then happened after the report is really a rather depressing reflection of the policy making process in the UK, because the report was presented to the Prime Minister. It was then handed on to John Burt, who's a kind of private citizen, former head of the BBC, an advisor, sort of informal advisor to Tony Blair. He then had to shape the analysis in the report into some kind of policy recommendations. And rather than saying, okay, supply side drug interventions aren't working, maybe we need to look at some more radical options like legalization and regulation or decriminalization and so on. He basically said in his report, which is still unpublished, but some details have emerged from it. He said in the second report, which follows on from the one which is now in the public domain, we can't do anything about drug supply. We have to try and affect drug demand. And the way to do that is to use coerced treatment to get the most problematic drug users into forced treatment. And if they're in treatment and they're being tested for drugs, they won't be using drugs. And if they're not using drugs, they won't be stealing, and therefore crime will go down. And that was basically his response, which was really very one-sided. You know, he was supposed to be a blue sky thinker. This is someone who was supposed to have, you know, be able to think out of the box. And clearly didn't, because rather than addressing the root of the problem, which was the illegality of the market and how that inflated prices and attracted criminals to the market and forced addicts into crime, what he's done is say, right, we're going to get the addicts and threaten them with prison as a way of forcing them into basically coerced abstinence. It's really very disappointing, and I think there's more on this still to emerge. The second part of the report isn't in the public domain yet. Hopefully it will be at some point. And I think it's going to be very, very revealing about the sort of populist, political, rather corrupt, and I use that in the loosest sense, nature of the policymaking process in the UK.
Well, Steve, as I understand it, the minute we regulate these drugs, we basically destroy the drug cartels, Osama's stash becomes worthless, the gangs have less reason to exist, and overdose deaths will basically disappear. What is the plus side of continuing this?
Well, you know, your analysis is right. There would seem to be great benefits from moving the drugs market within the government sphere and legally regulating it in a way appropriate to the risks of the drugs in question. Not least a reduction in crime by basically collapsing the illegal markets. It's the same rationale that applied to the end of alcohol prohibition when Al Capone took over and the whole experiment was a complete disaster, so eventually they legalized alcohol again. And there's been a lot of writing on this. There's a lot of academic work, there's a lot of high-level policy work, a lot of people in the police, the judiciary, medical community, academia, and the non-government field all think this is something that we should be looking at. The motivations for maintaining the current failing policy are primarily political. You have to see it in the context of, you know, a whole generation, maybe 20 or 30 years, of quite hardcore drug war rhetoric, which has very much sort of polarized this in the same way that the war on terror does, as a kind of oversimplifies and polarizes it as a sort of issue of good versus evil. And if you paint drugs and drug users, and particularly drug dealers, as sort of evil, that sort of contemporary folk devils, then anything you do really to combat them is automatically synonymous with good, and that the whole sort of enterprise begins to take on a sort of pseudo-religious hue, where you have this very sort of polarized morality, very simple, clear-cut battle against good and evil, and in that context, kind of rational policy-making, looking at evidence of effectiveness, looking at performance indicators, looking at the evidence, that whole kind of more scientific, rational approach just goes out the window, because it's become a kind of crusade, a moral crusade, a kind of religious-style moral crusade, and it is of a benefit to politicians, and they, unfortunately, are the people who are in control. And for some politicians, they still think there is populist capital to be gained by stoking fears about drugs and then putting in place tough-sounding legislation to address those fears, even though it doesn't work. And an increasing number of the policymakers who actually do that stuff clearly know that it doesn't work. So it's very cynical, I think, and that's basically your answer. It's cynical, populist politics at its worst.
Thank you for that, Steve. Now, I think I can also draw kind of a parallel to the war of terror, as you've done, that how can we give up now? Those people will have died in vain, and all these drug warriors would have had a career in vain if we were to give up.
Well, there's no easy answer to that. I mean, the fact is there are, you know, very big institutional and structural barriers to making the kind of change that we're talking about. I think what's going to happen is it's going to need to be phased change, with moving in small steps, maybe decriminalization of personal possession of drugs first, followed by perhaps legalization of cannabis and an expansion of prescription drugs for certain dependent users. And then it's going to have to slowly move on from there. There's also the very serious issue of the UN and the UN drug conventions to which the UK, the US, and pretty much all countries in the world are signed up to, that basically require under international law that we do have certain penalties for, you know, under basically enshrining prohibition into the law of all those countries. So there are a lot of international legal issues as well. Although intellectually it's a fairly easy exercise, in practical terms it's very complex and it will take a number of years. So it's not something that's going to happen very soon, but I think within 12 to 15 years there'll be substantive moves internationally, led by progressive countries in Europe, aided, I think, by the South American countries who are being ripped apart by the sort of illegal drug profits, and probably a couple of other countries such as Canada and Australia and New Zealand, who are a bit more progressive and pragmatic than the US. But unfortunately, US policy is going that way in a lot of areas. It's taking a very sort of moralistic tone. A lot of the stuff they're doing with sexual health and prostitution and abortion and abstinence and all that stuff is taking a rather similar hue. So there may have been some progress in the US, small progress in the sort of late 90s, but it's all been reversed in the Bush administration. It seems to be rowing backwards, and unfortunately, where the US leads, the rest of the world tends to follow, certainly England, because of our particularly close relationship. I mean, the UK has a very harsh regime compared to most of our European neighbours, which are much more liberal and a lot less hardcore in terms of their drug war enforcement policies. But we have this relationship with the US, and the US is unfortunately the country in the world least willing to let go of their drug war rhetoric.
We've been talking with Steve Rolls, the information officer with Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK. Steve, a closing thought, a website, what would you like to tell my listeners?
Transform do a lot of interesting work. If you're interested to find out more, do visit our UK website, which is www.tdpf.org.uk. That's TDPF for Freddie, .org.uk, and find out more. And if you're interested, by all means contact us or send us an email, and we can help with any questions you might have.
Here we go again. Tony Blair has been taking a lot of flack because he buried a bogus report that stated we should abandon our fight against drug addiction because winning the war on drugs would be hard. Of course he buried it. It was stupid. A roster of twisted facts and misinformation drowning in the opinion of its author. In fact, the few facts found within the report illustrated the extent of the drug epidemic. Quote, police would have to intercept 80% of drugs entering Britain to affect supply. Seizure rates are 20% at best. Now, what does this prove? Drug legalization advocates have predictably come to the conclusion that this shows unequivocally that we should end the drug war. Who would have guessed? But let's be rational for a moment. Without the rule of law, there is no order. We must not abandon our laws when their enforcement becomes difficult. Our entire civilization depends on this principle. The report suggested that we should allow all of society to fall victim to addiction because doing what is necessary would, quote, pose a substantial challenge to law enforcement. And Tony Blair buried it. How could anyone blame him? This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Numbness, tingling, dry cough, weight loss, persistent fever, night sweats, a bad rash, swollen face, trouble breathing, severe allergic reaction, lymphoma, nervous system disorders, tuberculosis, and fatal infections. Time's up. The answer, from Abbott Laboratories. Humira for arthritis, and yes, it is approved by the FDA. Meantime, the drug DEA law judge Francis L. Young called perhaps, quote, the safest therapeutic agent known to man, end quote, marijuana is used by thousands of people worldwide to safely and illegally treat their arthritis.
Today we're speaking with a couple of people out of Canada, the first folks I'm aware of to have tried Sativex, the under-the-tongue full cannabis spray developed by GW Pharmaceuticals. And first we're speaking with a member of law enforcement against prohibition and a lady who has multiple sclerosis, Allison Merton. If you would, tell the folks a little bit about your condition.
I suffer from chronic progressive multiple sclerosis and a nasty pain in my face 24 hours a day called tic douleur rue. And I've suffered from that from the age of about 13, Dean, so...
Allison, let me ask you this. You have had the chance to try the Sativex spray. Have you had any success with it?
I haven't seen much relief as of yet, although yesterday I was thinking I felt better maybe because of it. I was taking a little bit more than usual, and I think now that I've upped my dose a bit, Dean, I think I'm finding a little better result than I was at five sprays a day, which is probably... would put most people into bed, but because of the number of pharmaceuticals and the amount of pharmaceuticals I take and narcotics I take every day, I'm a really huge deal, I guess, when it comes to taking medications. So as I said, when I actually took the number of sprays that I took five in the morning and then took 10 later in that day, so I had 15 in that same day, whereas I know another gentleman who's on Sativex had three sprays of Foric, and I got none of that at 15 sprays, so...
Well, then again, Allison, you have one of the most painful conditions that a human being can endure, this tic douleur rue, and let's talk about perhaps some of the other medications that you do have to take in order to deal with this.
You bet, Dean. If I don't have medical marijuana in any form, I take 2,000 milligrams of morphine and up to 32 other pills every day, and I've done that for about 15 years. I'm 41 years old, so it's actually been a long regime for somebody as young as myself. So I definitely don't want to do the pharmaceutical route if I can help it. It's too much for me. It's too hard on my body.
So you are beginning to see some measurable positive effect of this Sativex?
I'm not sure. I'm hoping so. As I said, I'm hoping I'm just able to keep up my amount of spraying at 15 sprays for the last couple of days, so I'm not really sure. As I said, I'm hoping, though, it's going to give me some good effect. You know, that's at least what I'm hoping for, as I said, from this. I mean, I need something when I run out of marijuana, the raw marijuana, and then don't have anything else. So this is definitely a step in the right direction.
My name is Philippe Lucas. I'm the founder of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society and Canadians for Safe Access and director of communications for Drug Sense, one of about 800 Canadians who are legally allowed to use marijuana for medical reasons.
Well, Philippe, along that line, you recently had the occasion to use the new product, the whole cannabis extract Sativex. Tell us about that product, its use, and your perceptions.
The entire experience was a very personal experience. I don't want anyone to take my experience as the gospel. Cannabis medicines, like any other medication, will react differently to different people's conditions, symptomology, and biokinetics. But my experience was interesting. And as someone who's had a chance to a long-term exposure to ingestion through smoke form, as well as to pharmaceutical versions of cannabis like Marinol, Sesamet, and byproducts made by compassion clubs like the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, we have an oral mucosal spray called Cannamist, I felt that I was in a good position to judge the GW product on a short-term basis, so determine its effects over 5 days' time. I have no doubt that this product is effective. I've looked at a lot of research. I was a believer before I tried it. For me, the use of medical cannabis is a really scientific pursuit. I think it's well supported by the science, and certainly GW has done a lot to support their claims and statements that this could be a viable analgesic and even an anti-emetic and an anti-nausea. In other words, that it could have the same, that it could address the same symptomology as we would traditionally assume whole plant cannabis would. And of course, that's because it's a whole plant cannabis medicine. So it was marginally effective in addressing my symptoms. It was, it dealt with my nausea and loss of appetite, which I suffer from hepatitis C, fairly adequately. Once I'd established the dosage and the titration, which took me a few days to get used to how much I should be using, what was the right amount for me, I found it to be actually fairly predictable. For me, it's not going to be a replacement for smoked cannabis. That still would be my preferred method of ingestion. But I think that for a lot of people who would never try smoked cannabis or have access to a safe supply of whole plant cannabis, I think that this could be a viable alternative. And so for that reason, I certainly hope that you're able to get approval for GW in the U.S., or that I should say that GW is able to get approval for Sativex in the U.S., because I really do think that it could be a great addition to the choices and options for medical marijuana patients in America.
According to a survey performed by New York's Beth Israel Medical Center and the North American Syringe Exchange Network, and published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the total number of syringe exchange programs in the U.S. declined from 154 in 2000 to 148 in 2002. The number of states and territories with needle exchange programs also declined from 35 to 32. Yet even with fewer programs, the total number of syringes exchanged actually increased by some 10%, from 22.5 million in 2000 to nearly 25 million in 2002. These programs also provide health care information, HIV testing, condoms, and other essential services to some of the hardest to reach yet most in need segments of the population. Public funding of needle exchange programs dropped by nearly one-fifth in 2002 compared with 2000. Private funding helped make up the shortfall somewhat. The total spent on syringe exchange programs rose slightly to $13 million overall in 2002. That's $13 million with an M, which means they operated at an average cost of 50 cents per syringe. The lifetime cost of caring for an HIV-positive person is estimated to be about $200,000, yet it can be prevented with a 50-cent syringe. A better bargain would be hard to find. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Jury nullification ensures the citizen juror a more equal status with those who write the laws. Please visit the Fully Informed Jury Association, FIJA.org. Please keep such decisions private. Nullification is your right, your responsibility, perfectly legal and just.
Hello, folks. This is Nora Callahan with the November Coalition. The March on Washington, D.C., August 13th, plans continue to unfold online at journeyforjustice.org. But do not forget that Friday evening there is a welcome reception. The theme is getting to know each other, and it's at the City Hall, the Mayor John A. Wilson Building on 1350 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. And there will be public officials there to greet us as well. So we're getting very excited about the march.
Once again, I remind you that drug war is a complete fraud. And unless you do your part to help end this abomination, you or members of your family will be made to suffer the consequences. Next week, our guest, Dr. Frank Fisher, will be talking about pain in today's America. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.